Every human being has to discover the moment in our lives where we tap into our own courage. And my study of storytelling, myths and fables, Hollywood stories, movies, it all comes down to the lead character discovering courage. Now, courage is not something we're born with. We may be born with mischief and daring do and be provocateurs. But courage is when you tap into your own fear and you dare to break through to a new way of living in the world. And every person has to discover that on their own. And once you tap into that, when you spark the courage in your own heart, you will go into all new direction. It will take you places you would never thought you would go. It's a rite of passage.
This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callahan.
I've always been intrigued by what makes people successful,
what success means to them, and how we can apply their techniques to make our lives more successful. If you want to raise the profile of your business or your personal brand, having your own podcast is a great way to achieve it. I'm giving away 50 of my top secrets that help get this exact podcast to number one and created a stack of exciting opportunities. For your free download, go to mypodcastsecrets.com. That's mypodcastsecrets.com.
Subscribe, rate, and review the We Make Success Happen podcast.
Hello and welcome to We Make Success Happen. Today, all the way from Hollywood, it's the amazing human Bobette Buster. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, you're this story guru, but we were just talking. You don't really like to be known as that.
It feels embarrassing. I mean, there are many people who make a living, you know, teaching and consulting on story, but it just happens to be a position that I have done in many different aspects around the world, you know, teaching it as a professor, as well as an executive in Hollywood and a consultant in production companies and for corporations. So for lack of a better term, that's what I'm called.
And you work with big film giants like Sony and Pixar and Disney.
Yeah. Inside the industry, it's been very gratifying to work with their story teams. I was on the faculty at the University of Southern California Graduate School of Cinema, where I also graduated from. And I was on that faculty for almost 25 years. And now I'm professor of the practice of storytelling in Boston at Northeastern University in the School of Journalism, where I'm developing a whole series about satire and how it influences culture and democracy. And while I'm doing my other work as a writer producer, I'm working with a great team in Boston, and that's been really gratifying. But I also travel all over the world. I'm on the guest faculty in Italy at the Catholic University of Milan, where they have an exceptional master's program in screenwriting, and I work in-house with the major studios. So it's a diverse career. And then I do these storytelling workshops, which is how I met you, Matt. And that's a great pleasure, because part of the whole, what my philosophy about this is that everyone has a story. And most people say, oh, my life isn't so interesting. Or they think the story is something else. But once you allow people to listen to their own stories and you create a listening environment, it's amazing when it's the story behind the story comes out. And my experience is, after, you know, 10,000 listenings or more, is that once people get in touch with their own story, it's inevitable that the telling of that story actually affects the common good. It makes the world better. They both have the catharsis of telling the story, and they also, the story tells each person something about themselves as they listen to who they are. So I have observed that storytelling is more than just, oh, let's sit around the fire or listen to grandpa in his rocking chair. Storytelling is an extraordinarily important device that we need as human beings to connect. It's probably the most primal way that we connect. We break down our egos and we get to know someone else. And the big thing I've realized is that none of us have enough imagination to lead our own lives. So we need to hear other people's stories to stay inspired and to stay in a state of wonder and curiosity and to create open minds. That's the only way you can move a democracy forward, is by listening to the other person's point of view.
Yeah, because your course was absolutely amazing. It was, I would say it's probably the best course I've been on. Everyone who was on that course kind of tapped into the thing that really makes us tick, I suppose, our real fire, I guess, or, you know, you talk about the spark and stuff, and actually going, probably we've all got a spark that we can use, as you said, for like common good or to inspire other people, or pass that kind of spark on or the flame on to other people and hopefully ignite positive change.
Well, I mean, in all frankness, Matt, you were an example of someone who, and I would love it if you would tell the story, maybe you already have, of how you were just shooting an episode with George Clooney and Bill Murray. And I love this idea that you were shooting, you were looking through the camera lens, the camera actually magnifies something. And they had an idea that you literally magnified in your own spirit and came away so inspired by. Can you tell a bit of that story? And then I want to expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, some of the audience may have heard me talk about this, but actually you, Bobette, kind of really helped me sort of tailor the story a bit more so it becomes more engaging, I guess. The little kind of details that really make a story work. So I'll try and tell it as best as I as I can. Yeah, so it was about 5 years ago, I'd been asked to film a documentary with George Clooney as part of a wider TV program for American TV. And yeah, I was sitting there opposite George Clooney in his UK house, looking through the lens. And my dad got me into filmmaking, and he'd passed away at 58 from cancer. And I was thinking how proud my dad would have been of me kind of looking through this lens, sitting opposite this major film player, this major kind of film star. Yeah, I had also become a dad at that point. I think my son was one. So I was looking through the lens and just sort of thinking, initially, I wasn't really connecting with George because I was just thinking he's so far out of my kind of league, I guess, in my head. And then he started talking about the difference that we could all make. You know, anyone can make a difference. And I ended up becoming inspired by what George was talking about, and actually that we all of us should be making a difference, you know, we all have the internal skills to go out and make a difference, however small it is. So I ended up becoming inspired by what George did, and I was also thinking about my dad and actually thinking he was a really kind man in the community. I was thinking, as a dad, perhaps I need to be more like my dad and take the example of George and actually go, yeah, all of us has the capabilities to make a positive difference in the world if we want to.
Well, didn't you go right out and wasn't the idea of what is the one thing you can do, and you decided to create this Pay It Forward campaign where you...
Yeah, tenor for good and we make good happen, yeah.
Yeah. And that... So as an example of what I might do when I'm listening to someone, is you came into the course sort of downplaying this episode and sort of being sheepish and sort of like, well, yeah, I got to take George Clooney's, you know, story, and I got to be there and la la la. And I could hear that there was something larger that happened to you, that there was a connection. And I became, I was listening to what I call the gleaming detail, which was you were shooting him and there was something about the magnification of an idea that just handed off the spark. You know, George Clooney is very clear about the fact that he has been blessed greatly and he feels honor bound to give back. Oddly enough, I mean, George Clooney and I came from the very same area of the United States. His father was a news broadcaster in Cincinnati, where I grew up, and George grew up there. And his aunt, Rosemary Clooney, was very famous. She was on this Christmas show every year with Bing Crosby called White Christmas. And my parents, we'd always watch it and go, oh, that's Nick Clooney's sister, you know, blah, blah, blah. So George and I grew up in the same region, and then we were both in Hollywood around the same time, but obviously his path was acting. And I was always impressed at his values, that he never forgot the common touch. And I believe that's actually what made him a star. And so what I was touched by is that you doing your job actually connected with his message, and it went, it had a ripple effect that was huge. And I wanted you to hear the story behind the story. And so as we deconstructed that moment in the class, sort of like you crystallized your energy fully around what you got out of that experience.
Yeah, I mean, you came up with a brilliant line when I was talking about Tenor for Good and We Make Good Happen. You actually said, it's all about sparking the joy of human kindness.
Yeah.
And that's become the tagline for We Make Good Happen. So well, I owe you a few dollars for that, I guess.
I do think that's what happens when that's really all we can do in life is spark each other and be present to each other. I mean, we all know the irritant of someone who gets on our nerves and we're like, it's a grinding, you know, energy in our lives. It can grind you down. So the issue of just sort of moving through life and sparking joy or sparking some connection, you know, there G.K. Chesterton said, or it's apocryphal that he said, never underestimate the 5-minute conversation with a teenager, which I think is really funny, because you know that you really think you're not connecting with teenagers, but they're really in a prime moment in their lives to just, they're rich soil, and just to plant some idea, if you just get them for 5 minutes, you can really do something. But as I pondered that, I realized that most of us are moving so fast. A 5-minute conversation is actually deep time really anymore. And so I take that on board, you know. I always feel like when I get in a cab or an Uber, you know, that's a rich moment to connect with someone whom you'll never see again. I've had some amazing encounters.
How can people who might be watching this or listening to this, how can they find their story or the right story that's inside them?
Everybody, I've never seen it to fail that everyone has a story that they must tell or that they're afraid to tell. And if you create the right environment where someone feels heard, so, you know, J.K. Rowling said, no story exists unless someone wants to listen. And that's another thing about our world. We're all moving so fast, and there's this remote control in our heads right away when we meet someone, you know, where we're ready to click them off or move on fast. So the idea of just sitting around and taking time to be with people is where I grew up. You know, it was called a front porch society. If someone came along, you made time. You sat down and, you know, there was always pie or cake ready to be served and a cup of coffee. And you, the, the evenings would become very long and languid, and the storytelling would, you know, weave in and out of hilarious stories, historic stories, something sad, and then deep sighs, and then great laughter on a story. So I grew up in listening to the pacing of storytelling and the pacing of moments. So if you can listen and lean into people, you will inevitably find something has happened to them and that they need to tell or they need to tune into. And I guess I always see that it centers around a threshold moment in their lives, a moment where they had to discover the courage to break away and do something new, or they experienced a tragedy that stopped them in their tracks, or they had a great epiphany and they go, this happened to me. And if you think about it, most of us, gossip, news, everything is about, this just happened to me. You just woke up to something. And so what I'm listening to is, what is that one thing someone has to tell? You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, a person usually tells you who they are and what's on their mind within two or three sentences. So if you're willing to listen, you're actually tuning in to what's beneath the surface. So I try to be present with people as best I can in this busy world. And I have been blessed so many times with remarkable encounters, insights, hilarious points of view I wouldn't have had otherwise. And, you know, in my travels, for example, there's no way to express how mind-altering and heart-opening it is to encounter strangers in foreign places and take a few minutes with them. First of all, they're amazed that you're interested. And they will start to talk to you. They may give out to you because, after all, I'm the American, and so I represent the ugly American, and so I've had people take out their wrath on me. But other times people have said, wow, you really interested in this? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So creates a dimension to the world that we would, you know, why are we here if we're not tuning into each other? And wonderful threads of opportunities happen when you just stop and listen to someone else and take the time. It's about time.
I think there's so much power in actually listening, isn't there?
Well, that's I've written two books, one on do story, the other one on do listen.
It's
sort of the yin and yang. You can't have one without the other. And listening, what I realized is there's just two responses to listening. The first one is, oh, that person made me listen, you know, and no one likes to be around a boring person, someone who goes on and on and on. Or they're just not taking the cues that you need to move the conversation forward or you need to leave. But then the other response I've had from people is, wow, that person really listened to me. And it seems to be one or the other, because people want to be heard. But I think the biggest point about storytelling is all of us, every human being has to discover the moment in our lives where we tap into our own courage. And my study of storytelling, you know, in myths and fables, Hollywood stories, movies, etc., it all comes down to the lead character discovering courage. Now, courage is not something we're born with. We may be born with mischief and daring do and be provocateurs, etc. But courage is when you tap into your own fear and you dare to break through to a new way of living in the world. And every person has to discover that on their own. And once you tap into that, when you spark the courage in your own heart, you will go into a whole new direction. It will take you places you would never thought you would go. It's a rite of passage. It's like, you know, all the metaphors you can think of, you know, the butterfly coming out of the, you know, cocoon, all of that, you take flight. And most people are afraid because they have been beaten down by life, or they have natural fears of expression. But each one of us is required to step through and discover our own courage. And storytelling is always wrapped around the fulcrum of that moment. And if you do break through, those are the great heroic stories. If you break through or don't have the courage to, and you let the ball drop, those are the tragedies. And those are the cautionary tales. And we're actually almost more compelled by cautionary tales. From Hamlet on down, the great tragedies are telling us, they're warning us, please don't do this. And we are absolutely inspired by their example. So that's what I'm listening to, is the need to discover courage, or that moment when someone did. And everyone has that in their lives.
What would you say to those people that may be too fearful to delve, to go through that rite of passage and have that courage to face their fear? What would you say to those people?
Well, everyone has that fear. Everyone does. And there are universal fears we all have. Fear of flying. You know, I understand the two greatest fears are fear of public speaking and fear of flying. But I don't have a fear of public speaking, obviously, because that's what I do for a living. I have other fears. But we, you know, you may have a fear of, you know, women typically have a fear of little crawling creatures, whatever. You have a fear of being known. But then each one of us has a unique personal fear, a fear of that is triggered by shame and inadequacy. The point is we all have those fears. I guess my biggest point would be look at it from above. Look at how many people who've crossed over and dared to step through their fear. And all it takes is a baby step. There's some magical force that happens. If you just take one step through your fear, forces align and help you get through it. And I want to give people the courage to see the bigger picture and say, okay, this is a moment. I am paralyzed. This may mean that I will be very lonely and people will reject me. That's a huge fear, exile, that the group will come after you because you dared to do this other thing. Huge fear. I would say you're not going to become fully alive till you do it. And daring to do it, I will give you example after example of people who dared to do it. And once they did it, they prospered beyond belief. So that's what I would want to encourage people to hear. Is the power of storytelling to give you a visualization of what happens when you dare to walk through your worst fear. I see it over and over again. And when I'm watching any great person who's maybe extolled on the news, a sports figure, celebrity, ordinary people who rise to the top of our consciousness, say from the Black Lives Matter movement, I know that the reason they're standing there is because they had a moment in their life where they said, I'm going for it. And they did. And they broke through. And it's just remarkable to me how many people who are living sort of a shadow life, who are living sort of on the side of their life, it's safer there. But at the end, you know, there's this deep, you know, it's what Thoreau said, most men lead lives of quiet desperation because they're too afraid to step out. You know, Thoreau famously stepped out and lived in a cabin along Walden Pond for 18 months. I often think about the 18-month thing because, you know, Van Gogh, at the end of his life, his great, great burst of creative energy was in 18 months. Anne Frank, isolated in the attic, she wrote that diary in about 18 months. When you think about what can happen in even just separating yourself for 18 months, imagine. That's just an example of the daring to take yourself apart and take yourself seriously.
Yeah, because I mean, I had a massive fear of public speaking 5 years ago. There was one situation where I stood up in class I've now found out that I've got mild dyslexia, and she kind of stood me up in class and berated me. This is probably when I was about 11, 12. Stood me up in front. Yeah. not impressionable at all. And she stood me up in front of the class and thought I was taking the mick because I was spelling a word the wrong way round, like the letters were mixed up. And she stood me up, berated me, and I could feel myself going red. I could feel the shame. And then, you know, the other kids started laughing, and I could, you know, I can still imagine, or, you know, in my brain, visualize the guy behind the class geek banging the desk because he was just like wetting himself with laughter so much. In my head, that became a limiting belief because I didn't want to repeat standing up in, because I thought those things might happen again. And it was actually, you know, part of your course, your brilliant course, helped me find my voice and actually having the purpose of We Make Good Happen or being trying to inspire others, that purpose became bigger than my fear. And actually, it was something my wife also said to me. She said, it's not about you, you know, and actually when you're getting up on stage and doing public speaking, it's not about you. It's about like the stories that you tell or the value that you give to the audience and the difference that you can make, the joy that you can spark in someone, the action that you can spark in someone. I'm really big in now of like pushing people to step in and get visible, get into the arena. And it's kind of like what you were saying is get past that fear, because actually once you push through that fear, it's a really powerful platform and you're now in a really powerful place to inspire others or get other people to take positive action.
The thing I have observed now, we're in a really rare and wonderful threshold moment with social media. We hear a lot of complaints about it, and yes, it has created a culture of trolling and snark. But the whole idea of putting your work out there to the world and hearing and seeing that go viral, in the best sense of the word, is the impact you have with people you would otherwise never have known or met and may never ever see face to face. And in my little realm of my books and what I do, every week I hear from somebody from the furthest most reaches of the world, Tanzania, New Zealand, parts of Canada. I will never visit these places, and yet my work has had impact with these strangers. There's been a connection. And I know this to be true for anybody. You know, look at the impact of YouTube and, you know, algorithmic sort of, you know, forwarding of stories and ideas. And I no longer see this as an issue of, you know, people say, who's your target audience? And that is very necessary to know when you're focusing your ideas. But my target audience is ultimately that one person whom I will never meet, who I know needs to hear what I have to say, and it will lift them up to a new way of seeing the world. And that's who I'm relating to. I come from this small region of America in Kentucky, small town America, and Ohio, where my grandparents had farms and lived a small town life. I watched as the time went on that this region, which was, you know, wholesome all-American region, became inundated by methadone, methamphetamine and opioid crisis. And lives were just being absolutely wasted by addiction. And now it had come to small town America, and it was inundating and overloading the first responders. And they were having to be on call all day and having to bring people back to life. And it's just a huge overarching problem in our culture now. And there's many reasons for this, a terrible addiction era. And I saw a film with a young woman who could have been me, who was in such despair because she was trying to come out of her opioid addiction. And she was actually being helped by the judge, by the court system. Everybody was trying to get people like her into rehab and to restore their lives to themselves. This is a woman in her 20s. And she said, the thing is that I wake up every day sober and I hate the day and I hate tomorrow and I can't believe I'm still alive. Why am I still alive? Well, that living in that level of such despair in an area where there is opportunity and beauty and there was, you know, it's a heartland community, but what is it to live with that overwhelming sense of I hate living? And I thought, if only I could reach out to her and say, this is an episode in your life. This, you just keep walking through the wilderness. Loneliness is part of the spiritual journey. And once you get through the loneliness and you keep walking, you will find a new day. You will find a new way out of this. I wanted to give her the big picture somehow. And so when I think about storytelling, I think about someone like that who's lost to themselves.
Guess you're essentially trying to give hope to someone, aren't you?
Yeah, I do think that ultimately storytelling is how we crack through our egos and our limitations and create meaning in life and purpose. This is the only way. The only way that we learn about each other is to stop and listen to your story. Who are you? What can I learn about you that I didn't know otherwise? That's my favorite exercise when I teach storytelling is we start off with the exercises. Tell us a story about yourself that we would otherwise never know. And I have heard the most remarkable stories. And they're spellbinding. And they're actually ordinary stories that become extraordinary in the telling. And it's because most of us, when we meet each other, we're superficial and we talk about whatever's going on in the culture or the weather or the sports. We're not really talking about who we are. And once you give people permission to tell something about themselves, sky's the limit. Now, you need someone who curates the group, someone who won't. There are people who don't know when or how to stop talking, and there are people who are too shy, which is what I always love about the Native American culture, the Indians, if you will, who had a talking stick. And they would have, and they, that was to compensate for the fact that there were big talkers and there were people who held back, the introverts and the extroverts. And what you could hold the talking stick for a certain period of time, and then you had to hand it off. That meant that everybody in the group got their moment, and it was understood. So I feel like that is a social contract you have to set up when you're doing storytelling, is to create a proper flow of listening and convening with each other.
Because how did you get into storytelling, or how did you know that storytelling or teaching storytelling was your thing then?
Well, it was the air I breathed. It was the water I swam in when I grew up. I grew up in a region of the United States famous for its storytellers. It was small town America in Kentucky. You know, as the as the crow flies, my family had been a Revolutionary War soldier, and we were given a Revolutionary War land grant farm for my forebearer, having fought with George Washington, and that's what it says on his cemetery gravestone. They were remote regions, and so as the crow flies, who was just a few miles away with Abraham Lincoln, who was the great storytelling president. Also, the founder of American cinema, D.W. Griffith, came from a small town nearby. And also, not so far away, came Cassius Clay, who went on to become the great Muhammad Ali. And he was such a phenomenal communicator. He really understood himself and his story and reinvented his story. So if you're growing up in a cauldron of storytelling, it's just iron sharpens iron. I mean, it's like kids who grow up on the streets playing football, you know, whether it's Brazil or anywhere in the world, you're going to just, the cream will rise to the top, right? People become the best singers. They say if you're around an environment before you're 12, that's going to influence excellence in what you do. So I was just around great storytellers, and I was lucky. I was beyond lucky to have heard great storytellers in my own family. And I couldn't wait for the family occasions in which everyone came together and I would be sent away to bed, but they would find me at the bottom of the steps, having fallen asleep with my ear to the door or asleep under the dining room table, listening. You know, it was just, it was extraordinarily warm and giving. It was community and life itself. So it was the humanity that I was feeling. The laughter, the warmth, the love. You know, at times it was hilarious. At other times it was gripping. And what I realized in the end, looking back, is that the excellence of storytelling, the sense of pacing and what are the right details to give so you're not overloading the story. What details might have been missing? And they were just naturally talented people in my family. But, you know, honestly, it was the community. Everyone came together and made each other better. So when I went to Hollywood, you know, I didn't realize that storytelling was the lifeblood of Hollywood. You know, it's called development. Where do you find a story? How do you structure it? What makes it work as in a feature film or a TV structure? And people kept saying, wow, you have a knack for this, you know, and I would be in story meetings and I was just continually asked for my notes. And then USC, where I graduated from, they didn't have no one taught development. They thought it couldn't be taught. And they came to me and they said, what do we need? We're the greatest film school in the world. And I said, well, somebody needs to teach development. I'm in the middle of it. I know it can be taught. So they gave me the opportunity to create a development curriculum, an MFA, Masters of Fine Arts curriculum, which I did. And within a year, my students were selling their scripts for $1 million. And in the middle of Hollywood. So now there's a whole generation of students I've had the privilege of teaching now all over the world who work in development. They're executives, they're directors, they're writers. And that's led me. So the storytelling found me, and I just happened to be in Hollywood at a time when it was recognized this could be taught.
That's an incredible legacy to have, isn't it? That you've gone on and inspired all these people and created all these films and entertainment and, you know, that have then engaged loads of other people. That's an incredible legacy to have.
I see that I'm a person who has, I'm glad to have been a part of their journeys, but each one made their own way and they made their choices that made them successful. But every year, there's somebody in the top 10 in box office or Emmys or Oscars or BAFTAs who was a student of mine. And I'm proud of the fact that, you know, our paths crossed, you know.
Do you take commission?
Well, you know, you get paid in other ways. So
out of all of the things that you do, like teaching and working with big film studios and Disney and Pixar, what's the one thing that you absolutely love? What's the sort of top thing that you really engage with and kind of fills your heart with joy?
It's the connection. There is a moment when you're teaching, I've never seen it to fail, where there is sort of this, for lack of a better term, you step into the eternal. There's a flow in the room. The room connects. You can feel it. People are listening. They're in tune. And one of the things I do teach now is I want people to feel that connection, because it's very important when you're developing a movie, for example, and you're going through many iterations of the film and you've forgotten what's funny anymore because you've heard the line too many times. So you have to be able to go into an audience environment and feel the room. When is the story working? When are people distracted and restless? And when are they, you know, on the edge of their seat? And that's what I've come to realize is the great, great, it's the connection is what I draw from that. And it's life-giving. You know, I've had so many students return to me and say that the course meant something to their personal lives, that they became better people for it. Because I think if you're studying the truth of storytelling and asking the right questions of a story, you're asking the right questions of yourself. And that is, these are the profound questions of life. And so I'm constantly challenging people to ask these questions of any story they're developing. And also, what is your point of view? And why are you telling the story? And what do you want me to take away? Why should I care? These are the big questions. And people have said they've let me know afterwards that it's been transforming to how they live their lives. And that's humbling.
So you've got the Do Story and Do Listen books, and you also did the documentary, which is incredible, and I took my team to see it at the end of last year, which is Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. What was it like to be involved with that?
I basically, 1987, was taking a course with Jay Roach, who's going on to be a big director like Austin Powers and so many great films. He just recently did Bombshell, and he's done many great American TV shows for HBO, Recount and some others. But Jay Roach was my film production teacher, and he showed The Elephant Man, directed by David Lynch. And I'd seen it before and been very moved, but Jay deconstructed the sound design as created by Alan Splett, who was a great artistic collaborator with David Lynch. And it blew my ears wide open, because suddenly, we always say cinema, sight and sound medium, but people think of sound as, oh, the music, how does the music move you? But actually, there's a whole new art form that has grown up, particularly since the early 70s, in which they use sound effects on many levels to create emotion and meaning. And it's subtle, but it's immersive, and it has profound, layered potential to transform the story in a whole new direction beyond the music and alongside the music. And so once I understood that, I started analyzing the great films from that point of view and realized there was a whole class of sound designers, all of whom were inspiring each other, and a great class of directors who believed in sound's potential. And they had these great collaborations like George Lucas with Ben Bird and Francis Ford Coppola with Walter Murch and Gary Rydstrom with Steven Spielberg and Robert Redford and the Pixar films. And so I started teaching this around the world and asked often, because I would be deconstructing movies from various levels, but particularly in Italy, there was a group of directors who said, would you please just teach us a course on sound design? So I created a 40-hour course on that. And then Pixar asked me to bring it in-house to them. And when I was speaking in-house, who should be in the audience but Gary Rydstrom, who's won 7 Oscars for sound design, like Saving Private Ryan and Jurassic Park and Titanic. And I was like, oh my gosh, why is he in my class? So I went up to him and I said, Mr. Rydstrom, if you don't agree. And he goes, no, I love this. Let's go to lunch. And so we went to lunch, and then I was very cheeky, and I said, why isn't there a documentary? And 90 minutes would be easier to show this material than a 40-hour course. And he said, well, we're pretty busy, but he says, I'll back you to do it. And he said, if you do it, I will introduce you to all the leading players, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, John Lasseter, Robert Redford, and Walter Murch and Ben Burtt, et cetera. And so I put together a whole proposal, and then I took it to Gary, and we discussed it. And he said, why don't you partner with Midge Costin, who was the head of sound at USC? And I then brought in my other producing partner, Karen Johnson, who'd done a great documentary on stunt women in Hollywood called Double Dare that had been very successful. And we formed a company. And then I became very involved with fair use issues, which you call fair dealing in the UK, and I went to Washington, D.C. with the top lawyers in copyright, and we appealed to the Librarian of Congress. There's actually a person who has that position, for the right to be able to use clips from one movie and put it into another. And we ended up having over 1,000 different clips in our movie. We could not have made it without these clips. It would have been far too expensive. So I was working with them consistently to try to get the exemptions we needed to make the film happen. And therefore, the film many people tried to make the film before that, but didn't have the resources of fair use. But we were just at the right team at the right time, and we got incredible cooperation from the directors, from all the top directors, and the fair use of the clips. So it was a long project. We did end up walking the red carpet at Cannes last year and the BFI London Film Festival, and we're grateful it happened last year and not this year, because it wouldn't have been released. But I think the important thing about that film for me was the average person doesn't have the ears to hear sound and it's all of its power. And frankly, you don't want them aware of that. It's so immersive and subtle. But once you get the ears to hear it, it blows your perception of the world wide open. And that's what we were hoping to achieve. So,
yeah, it's a great documentary. We'll have to put the link in the show notes, because it's you can watch it online now, I think, can't you?
Yeah, it's available in many iterations, and you can certainly put the trailer link up there too. We're certainly available in the U.S. on Amazon and YouTube, iTunes, and we're available to purchase as well, and Blu-ray and DVD, and I think also in the U.K.
So talking about success now then, what does success mean to you?
I suppose success is about, are you growing in your process of being present in life? Are you enjoying life? Are you in gratitude? Do you have the freedom to continue flourishing and that? And also the people I've met along the way. I mean, extraordinary people I would never have otherwise met. So the experiences, the encounters, if you break through and have a success at a level of a film coming out, say, playing in a major film festival circuit, which we did, what surprised me, I wasn't looking for it, were the number of people from my past, from my childhood, my childhood sixth grade teacher, Noel Taylor, friends from high school and long ago friends who reached out to me, and it was like a happy reunion because they heard about the film that came to the screenings, and that was like a blessing. I hadn't planned on these rich encounters with people from the past, and it was catching up with them and who they were. So I think if you work hard and you're on the journey of what you're supposed to do, the real benefits are the people that you will meet along the way and the surprise encounters that you wouldn't have had otherwise if you hadn't taken the journey. If you're just thinking about it as the product that makes a big money and wins a big award, you know, I'm sure that's a pleasure. But what's actually happening are the surprise events that you would not have had an opportunity to be invited to if you hadn't put in the long hours, the hard work, the sacrifice. You're pushing through to another level of encounter and experience.
I like it. Okay, so last question then, Bobette. So imagine you've hired a little plane and there's a beach or a field full of all your kind of friends and family, and you've hired this plane, and behind the plane is one of those banners, and you can have whatever words of wisdom you want behind it that will then pass by all your friends and family. And these could be your final words of wisdom. What would you have on that banner?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I think the thing I'm really aware of now with the pandemic that we're all enduring is the idea of your personal good, your personal rights, your personal freedom. Is you're only free if you set someone else free. And you only experience love. If you love yourself, you are actually loving the community. And they have to go hand in hand. What you do for yourself is absolutely joined to the common good. They must go hand in hand. If you love the common good, you're actually loving yourself. And I would like to really reintroduce the idea that individual liberty means that you care about the liberty of all. And if we don't think in terms of the common good, we will have lost our own lives. So I guess I'd have to think about how do I put that on a banner? I'll try to come up with something quippy. But then I can ride in the sky, maybe. So,
on second thought, what I could say the banner would read is "Carry the fire." I'd be afraid that people down below would panic and go, "What? Where's the fire?" And the fire actually comes from a Native American tradition that Cormac McCarthy spoke about in No Country for Old Men, where they would be careful to carry fire within the horn of some great animal, like a buffalo, from one camp to another so that they could have light in the dark of the night and begin their campfires again. I see that as what matters, is that we carry the fire for each other, because your story matters and your story can change the world. So maybe I would say on the banner, "Your story matters," or "Any act with love lives forever." But that's too long for a banner. Anyway, I wish I was the Beatles or Yoda, so I guess I'll stay with "Carry the Fire."
That's lovely. Well, thank you very much, Bobette Bastow. I know it's very early, well, quite early in the morning, isn't it, there? So I really appreciate you
coming online. It's always a great pleasure. As I was saying to you, I think when we were not on camera, I would love to be in a beautiful place like Wales right now. You have the best of all worlds there, I think.
So, yeah, we'll put all the links to all your things that you've been involved with, like Do Story, Do Listen, those books, and they're all on Audible as well, and Making Waves, The Art of Cinematic Sound. Is there other things as well that we should be aware of?
I'm in the midst of writing a third book about these very issues we're talking about. The tentative title right now is Revolutionary Choices, you know, that when you're willing to make the revolutionary choice in your life, which feels like you're overturning your life, it actually is the thing that transforms the world while it transforms your own life. So that I'm writing that right now. And I'm putting sort of my big course, my storytelling course, I'm putting it online since we're in the world of distance learning now. That's a big project. So those are the things that are keeping me busy in lockdown.
Brilliant. We'll look out for all of those. Thank you very much, Bobette Bastow. It's been amazing. Hooray!
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Subscribe, rate, and review the We Make Success Happen podcast.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, I would really appreciate you leaving us a great review up on iTunes or your Apple Podcast app. It means a lot. Thank you very much. I've been Matt Callanan, and I'll see you on the next episode.
This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.
I see that as what matters, is that we carry the fire for each other, because your story matters and your story can change the world.